Okay, let's start with a little bit about, so just first about what you were doing at Oxford and when, and then we can sort of go back to your childhood.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I came to Oxford in 2015. I did my undergrad and master's in biochemistry from here. So yeah, I spent 4 years here and then I graduated in 2019. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So now just a little bit about your childhood. Where are you from? You know, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I'm from Lahore. I grew up in Lahore. I went to LGS 55 Main, Lahore Grammar School. I have 3 siblings. I'm the youngest in the family, but not pampered at all.
Really?
Yeah. I know everyone's first instance is like, if you're the youngest child, you're very pampered.
The baby of the family.
Yeah, but I think it's been the opposite in my family. I feel like everyone thinks I'm the most mature out of the other three.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think I just had the opportunity to learn from the elder three of my siblings. I think that's because I've always thought about, like, you know, not making the same mistakes that they did, or, you know, knowing that, like, this is the path that I wouldn't want to take, or this is the path that I would want to take. I have 2 elder brothers, and throughout my school time, they would be told off massively about, you know, not studying enough, not getting good grades. And I think my parents never had to tell me to, you know, study or to work hard or to take, you know, sciences or maths. It was just like all internal. And I think I probably, like, saw that, okay, you know, if I don't do this, they're probably going to be after me. So I wanted to avoid that. So, yeah.
And where are your siblings now? Are they back home or are they...
Yeah, so my sister is the eldest. She's married. She's in Canada. She has 2 sons. Then there's my elder brother. He's married. He's based in Pakistan as well now. Before they were he was working here in the UK as well, and he moved back during COVID. Same with my brother, the one who's like only 1.5 years older than me. He also did his studies from the UK. He went to King's College London, and then he moved back during COVID. So he's always his passion has always been acting, so he's kind of now in the film industry in Pakistan.
Oh, that's so interesting. What is it? So is it, has he started?
Yeah,
acting?
He's done a couple of dramas and some movies as well. Yeah,
oh,
one of his
lovely
movies came out like on Eid.
Which one is it?
I'm really bad. I should know this.
No,
okay, this can't be made public. He'll be like,
no.
It's,
oh, no,
yeah,
that's
I was very
okay.
guilty.
I didn't ask you about it later.
Because yeah, I was so, it was on Eid, and then, you know, Eid came on a working day here, so I couldn't go watch it in the cinema. Dagabazdil.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's a fun career. So it's like very different than the what the path you've chosen.
Yes, yes. I think a lot of times, because when I moved back to London, once I started work, after graduating from Oxford, I moved in with my brothers for like 6 months, but then COVID hit and they moved back. But during those 6 months, if I ever met anyone who knew them from before, and they'd meet me and they'll be like, are you sure you guys are siblings? Like, you're so different.
Okay, so a little bit about your childhood, you know, what was like at home? Just generally, what do you remember about, you know, what are your most, the best memories you have of your childhood?
Yeah, I think when I think about my childhood, like, it's very much close to my, like, elder brother. Like, his name is Momin, so he's only 1.5 years older than me. So we kind of, you know, grew up together, so... That's what I remember. Like, you know, we used to play a lot. We used to be very, very close to each other. But obviously, occasionally fight as well.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Siblings.
Exactly. And then the other thing that I remember is I was the favorite child of the family. Again, I think there are a few reasons for it. I think, like I said previously, everyone thinks I'm the most mature out of the 4 of us.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I and my mom always keeps saying this again and again that, you know, I was like the ideal child. I didn't really, you know,
tang nahi
kiya. Yeah, bilkul bhi tang nahi kiya. Yeah. She, like, that's the story I've heard on repeat, even, you know, even when I was, I think, like 5 years old or something. Even when I was a baby, when I bilkul, like, you know, tang nahi kiya. And then I think, when you have so much, I think, positive reinforcement, you just turn out to be like, you know, I know, like, I was a good child, so I was really good in studies as well. Like, I was very ustra. I remember from Dale, again, like, as soon as my as long as I can remember, I was like serious about my studies. Mm-hmm. And again, it was just internally motivated, weirdly enough. Like, and I think, again, it's linked to the fact that my parents didn't really put any pressure on me, so I felt like empowered to work hard. I think they always focused on the elder three siblings, and, you know, by the time they had me, they were like, you know, ye kuch kar hi legi. Like, they weren't too like focused, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, unki sari attention was on them, and that's what everyone says, you know, like, you, for example, like, for your first child, you're like too invested in you know, everything about their life, and then I just by the fourth
you
really calm down.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know,
they'll be okay.
But then also, obviously, I had especially like my elder sister, she's 7 years older than me, and my elder brother, he's like 6 years older than me. So I think both of them like really looked out for me. So, and my sister especially, I think, was like my second mom. Like, she would, so I think had a lot of ustara, people to look up to, and a lot of support being the younger sibling. I think it really worked in my favor. But yeah, like I said, my parents would always like, you know, tell everyone, okay, I'm so smart, I'm so hardworking, etc. Like, you know, they'd never be like complaining about me. But obviously with my brothers, they'd be like, itte shararti hain, you know, itta tang karte hain. So I do remember being like the ideal, or the trophy child of the family.
So, you know, since this is a project about being Muslim, so do you mind talking about the role sort of religion played, Islam played in your house?
Yeah. So the thing with like my house is my mom is, you know, what I remember from my childhood, I think by that time she turned like very religious. I don't think she was that religious like when my elder siblings were growing up. And my dad is like completely chill, like, you know, he's like very easy, and, you know, we like, now obviously like he prays 5 times a day, but, you know, back then kuch namaze padh li, kuch nahi matlab, you know, bas har cheez ke bare mein like easy. But my mom has always been like, you know, she would again take us jitna we like, I remember, I think for the two of us, for me and my elder brother moment, she really made an effort to make sure we are always in that kind of spiritual environment as well. So she would take us for Friday, like she would go for Friday prayers, even though it's not common in Pakistan for females to go, but she would go literally. So she would pick us up from school, where, you know, Fridays ki ek excitement hoti hai when you're back in school, okay, the weekend's coming up. She'd pick us up from school, she would have our lunch back, we would have lunch in the car, then she'd take us to the mosque. And obviously, you know, we'd listen to the, but we were kids, we would literally be playing with other kids in the mosque, but there was always that, you know, environment around us. And same with, I think, when, for example, like, we used to, like, during Ramzan, like, back home, my mom would really, because our neighborhood, like, where we used to live at that point, I think it was just generally, like, all the aunties were very religious, and they would, like, get together for like dars and Quran classes and stuff. So I think in Ramzan they have that Dora Quran. So Dora Quran, that's what it's called.
When you to finish it.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So you go through like the transliteration of the Quran for throughout the month. So she would make an effort ke it should be at, because everyone wants it to be at their house, so she would really obviously like offer our house for, because I think it changes every year, she would really want it to be at our house, because she said it's very difficult for me, this was when we were like a bit older, it's very difficult for me to get my children to come with me, but if I, and she was right, if it's in the house, there's no escape, right? You can't really go anywhere, so you have to attend. But when we were like younger, she would take me and my brother, like if she was going to a Quran class or if she was going to a Dars class, she would take us there. Again, we were very little, and you know, maybe half of the time I was falling asleep there. But I think those things do have, like now if I reflect, like they do have a big impact on your faith or your spirituality, because I feel like when I moved here, I kind of seeked that connection or that environment, I would say, because these environments are very peaceful. So yeah, I think religion played a big, big role because of my mom, like
a big role. So I, you know, before I talked to you about, you know, what you said when you moved here and you sought that community and the, you know, those religious spaces.
Yes.
But just before that, a little bit about what made you come to Oxford, what made you choose this particular subject, etc.
Before I actually come on to that, another thought that just came to my mind, which I forgot to like mention earlier about like religion and my childhood experiences. I think, yeah, it wasn't just about, you know, going to the mosque or seeking those like religious environments. My mom is a big, you know, like big on charity and doing something for others, and that's again what she's like really inculcated in all of us, and that's very much tied to religion as well. So again, I remember when I was younger, she would, when she would pick us up from school, she would take us to Eidi's orphanage, which was like I think a 10-minute drive away from our school, and we would spend time with the orphans there, and she would be speaking to all the widows there. Like she really made an effort to again like give us that environment, and you know, constantly like making us think how privileged we are and doing something for others as well. And same with, for example, like I remember, again, these are all like childhood memories which are coming back, but I remember there was this you know, kind of like helper, Aya, which we all grew up, like she really looked after us when we were growing up. And I think I might be like 10 or 10 maybe when she passed away. And then, but you know, like my mom, and I think her funeral was in a very like remote area, but you know, we went to her funeral and you know, like interacted with all of her family, which we didn't know like back then, but again, like really making sure that, you know, we kind of like also humble ourselves and not think that, oh, like we are better than someone else, if you get what I mean. Like again, like other like things that are coming to my mind. So again, there's another helper at our house who's been with us for like, you know, the past like I think 10 years or something. So when he got married, we obviously went to his gaon to attend his wedding, like ate the same food that they were eating. But then, because normally in our family, whenever someone gets married, it's very common to invite the new couple for a meal in their family. So she did the same with them, and you know, like again, obviously the whenever it's like a shadi ki daawat, like the new kind of like cutlery set comes out, right? Not like the one that you use for your daily ustara life. So she did all of that, and you know, they all sat on the dining table, we sat with them just like how we would. And again, I know, like, you know, in Pakistan it's not very common, like I have realized like people treat help very differently compared to how you know, they should be treated. So these are some of them. I'm sure they'll keep coming back, but I just wanted to add that there wasn't religion wasn't just about like you know, learning the Quran or seeking spiritual spaces, but it was really about helping others and doing, you know, again, she would every other week, she would distribute like ration to different families who were needy she came across. And again, I'm really close to my mom, so you know, anywhere she would be going, she would make an effort for me to come along, rather than, you know, like, so if she's going to the grocery store to get all the ration packed. And I think the other thing with her is she really likes to like put in the effort rather than you, because you know, now like a lot of times I tell her, you know, you can just ask the house help, or you know, like to go like to get the groceries packed that you want to give away, or you know, if she's sending food to like a government hospital near her house, I'm like, you know, the cook is there, they can cook. But a lot of times she's like, no, I want to do it myself because I want to be rewarded for that effort.
So that is what religion meant in your house. It was not only about, you know, going for Quran class or learning to recite. So that is how, you know, you remember the role of religion in your childhood. So Manahil, I also want to, you know, talk about the other side of religion, rituals and festivals. How do you remember Eid and Ramzan and all? You know, it's something that a lot of my childhood memories are tied to Eid. You know, so the bangles and the khana.
All the excitement was, you know, about all of that. I'll start with Ramzan and then move to Eid. I think, again, Ramzan was always like such a big thing in the family. And then I think because of my mom, it would be like, so every day she would, so I think, at one point we would be hosting like Sehri and Iftari at our home for all the, because there were a few slum areas near our house back then. So again, in Ramzan, I remember, like, obviously we wouldn't have any routine. Like, everyone would wake up around 2 a.m. Like, the house would be buzzing because they start preparing, like, all the help that we have as well. Obviously, my mom, they would be preparing for the sehri that needs to be distributed or, like, hosted, like, at our house. So that would happen, like, in our garage. So that went on for 5-6 years. But then I remember when the slum areas kind of, you know, over time the area developed, there weren't many slum areas. So she would send the sehri to Jinnah Hospital, like, one of the government hospitals near our house. So yeah, so and then obviously, like, you know, having sehri together, then we would wake up late if it's like the summer holidays or any of the holidays. If not, we'd have to go to school, obviously. I remember we did spend a lot of time sleeping as well in the afternoon, especially when it's like the summer months. And then again, same routine for iftari. I was very much involved in, I love fruit chart, and I don't know why it was a thing in our, I somehow took the responsibility of cutting the fruit chart every single day. Again, too much around my, like, it's my mom doesn't, she's very particular about cleanliness. So, you know, either she would cut the fruit chart because she doesn't trust anyone else, or, you know, like, she would trust me. So I somehow ended up, like, making the fruit chart for everyone. And then we would go for Tarawih as well. After iftar, my mom again would go every day, and she would tell me to come. And again, you know, at that point I was just like, I was a kid, I didn't really want to go. But then, you know, you kind of feel guilty about not going as well. So I would end up going with her for most of the time. But I think a lot, but I do remember, so she would read 12 Tarawis, and, you know, after 8 I'll be like, I'm exhausted, and she'd be like, yeah, it's fine, you can either go home or you can wait here. So I'll just wait in the mosque until she finishes. So I think the good thing was that she didn't really pressurize, like, me to do something, because otherwise I think you become rebellious, you don't want to do it. So she was always like, you know, whatever is easy for you. And I think that's why you kind of also want to do more, if that makes sense, if the other person or your parents are not really, like, pressuring,
imposing it on you.
But I think my dad made that mistake with my brothers. He would sometimes, like, not really try to impose it, that, you know, you haven't read your prayers, you need to read them. And then they would be like, you know, they would really be rebellious, that, oh, you know, like, we don't want to, or, you know, like, we don't want to at this point, like, make up excuses. But I think, yeah, but I realized it's very important to not impose, like, religion. That's very, very, I think, honestly, like, detrimental. I personally think so. And so, yeah, like, and then obviously, like, you know, during the taqrats, again, my mom would make it a big thing that we're all gonna, like, pray together and stuff. So this, honestly, really, really enjoyed Ramzan even as a kid. I started, like, fasting very early on. Again, I don't know. I just volunteered to, like, fast even before they were mandatory. So again, like, I think it probably, like, made my mom so happy. So kind of, you know, I seeked that as well, that I remember like the first time I kept my fast, it was such a big thing, and you know, everyone's like gifting you presents and stuff. So yeah, like Ramzan was really about also community. So, you know, you would really enjoy like having again people over for iftar and, you know, doing things together. Because again, during weekdays, we might not have like dinner together every day if, you know, everyone's has their own timings. But obviously you're having like sehri together, you're having iftar together, but also like having family members over. Yeah. So that was the fun bit. And then obviously about Eid was, you know, such a big event to look forward to. I would be so excited to have like three different outfits for the three different days, but also yeah, like, you know, matching bangles, shoes, jewelry, like everything.
Mehndi
on the Chandra. Exactly. Yeah. But Chandra was really about spending it with cousins. A lot of times I know we would also be like running after our darzi last minute when your clothes aren't ready, and you know that stress that, oh my god, tomorrow's Eid and we don't have our clothes ready. But but yeah, honestly, like, it was so exciting. Like, the feeling that you would get like back when you were kids, like looking forward to Eid. So sad that I don't feel that excitement now, like, you know, not like as being an adult. I don't know, I feel like Eid is mostly for kids now. I can really, really feel that, because even this year it's just like, I think as an adult you have so many responsibilities, so much going on, you don't feel like that level of excitement, whereas when you're a kid all you are thinking about is Eid.
The Eid and the the Mehndi and the food. But I think that is something that we can, I'd love to talk about more, but so let's move on to, you know, your journey to Oxford.
Yeah.
So, you know, why and when, basically.
Yeah.
And why this sub particular field?
Yeah. So I think, again, I always was like one of the top students in the class. And back in, I think it was like our break before like my GCSEs, like O level started, like in grade 9, we came to the UK. We used to come here for our summer breaks quite often. We had some family here. So I remember one of my cousin's wife's sister, she got into Oxford. And it was such a big thing, like, for everyone that, oh wow, like, you know, she, so I didn't know her personally, I'd like really like ever spoken with her one-on-one, but I obviously like knew of her. And I was, when I found out that, you know, she's going to Oxford, I was just like, wow, she was like some kind of a demigod, to be honest, that, oh my god, she got into Oxford and she's going to Oxford. So I think that's, and she went to KGS actually. That's when I think I started thinking about Oxford, or dreaming about Oxford, I would say. Like, I really...
How old were you?
So if I was in grade 9, I would be around 12,
yeah,
12, 13, yeah, around that age. So again, but you know, it's not like I told anyone that, oh, you know, it was something that, you know, I used to think about. And again, I would like search on YouTube about a day in the life of an Oxford student, and, you know, searching up on Google what, you know, life as an Oxford student is like. But I think like I really started thinking about it back then. And then over the years, I think it just, that dream kind of cemented. And then when I got to my A-levels, so both my brothers, they came abroad for their undergraduate. My sister did like a couple of exchange programs. So all of them had gone abroad for their higher education. So in my mind, I was like, obviously I'm also going, right? The elder three siblings went.
Yeah.
So when I spoke with my dad that, okay, you know, I also want to, so, and both my brothers were here in the UK, I was like, I also want to go. And he was like, no, like, you're not, unless you get into Oxford and Cambridge, I'll send you, otherwise, like, you know, LUMS is good enough where you can do or medicine. So then at that point, I was just so annoyed. I was like, that's so unfair, because no one from my school had ever got into Oxford for their undergraduate. So I obviously thought, I'm not going to get in, right?
Yeah.
And but he was like, no, like, that's the condition, you know, that's there, and so you know, it's up to you. You either get into Oxbridge or like Lumsys is good enough, you know. There's no point, I'm not gonna send you abroad. And I remember I was so annoyed at him for the longest time.
Why do you think that was?
He said that a while.
Why do you think he,
yeah, so he now, he like obviously once I got in, like he says that, oh, you know, like I knew you were super smart, I knew you had the potential, and that's why I wanted to give you that goal. Mm-hmm. At that time I didn't realize that, but you know, now in hindsight I think like he played such a big role in me getting to Oxford, because he kind of gave me a goal to work towards.
So it was like a motivational,
exactly,
thing for, technique for him.
Exactly. And I think it really, really worked. It did really motivate me, like, because again it was kind of like, you know, a goal that I was working towards. Like I knew why I was studying for my exam. Like I was internally motivated, right, rather than studying because, oh, like my parents want me to get good grades. Like I just had clarity that, okay, like
this is karna
hai. Exactly.
So okay, then tell me more about like sort of working towards this,
yes,
goal.
So I think, yeah, so obviously like I was thinking about it for a few years, to be honest, and I think that helped me also perform well in my school exams, because I knew for Oxford, like your internal transcript, your predicted grades, like grades really, really matter for Oxford admissions. I had read about the admission process early on, so I think I had you know, kind of like time was on my side, like the, because normally I feel like people start thinking about university when they get into A levels, but I had been thinking about it like since my O levels. And then I think when the time came to apply to Oxford, again I worked on it throughout my summer break. Before that, Oxford's deadline is 15th October, so throughout the summer break I scored really well in my GCSEs. In my O levels I got 80 stars in 2 A's, so again, you know, I knew I was on the right track. I could, like, I still had a chance to apply. I didn't think I was going to get in, but I was like, obviously I'm still going to apply. Like it really, really you know, that was something that really excited, the thought of going to Oxford just really excited me at that point. So I remember when I started writing my personal statement, again, like my sister really, really helped me out, because again I was always like a science math student, didn't really like writing essays and stuff, so she really like helped me with my personal statement. But my elder brothers as well, like anyone they knew of who had went to Oxford or Cambridge or any of the top universities, they put me in touch with them. And I remember speaking to a lot of people, again, because I was back in school, I was a kid, I didn't really know it. And again, I, because no one from my school had gotten into Oxford, I didn't know of anyone that I could reach out to. But I think that's where, again, like my being the younger sibling, like really worked in my favor. They were all very supportive, like they were really invested. They were like, you should speak to this person, just again to gain insights as to, you know, how to write the best personal statement. So I remember, because all of them were like, you know, you're the one who's like the nerd of our family. Yeah. Like I've had like really good grades throughout, so they were like, okay, you know, if anyone has a chance from our family, it's you. So I think, yeah, like they were really supportive. I had a chemistry teacher who's, again, like I think he also played a big role in me getting to Oxford. I was going to like a tuition center, so he used to he didn't teach at our school, but I used to go to him like externally.
Yeah.
And still, like, he was just so invested in his students, because the amount of times he literally read my personal statement like 10 times and gave me feedback that, you know, you can improve it like this, you can improve it like that. And then initially when I wasn't sure of what subject to apply for, I didn't like chemistry in my O levels, but once I started going to his tuition, he really made me develop a love for chemistry, and that's how I ended up applying for biochemistry to Oxford. Before, either I thought I'm gonna, so I, my elder siblings, my parents were okay, you know, they were like, do whatever you want to do. Again, you know, the fourth child, they're just, yeah, like, you know, she's, whatever she does, she'll be fine. But I remember, like, my elder brother was really wanted me to become a doctor. There's no, like, doctor in our immediate family. And he was like, you know, again, if anyone can become a doctor, it's you. But I never wanted, even though, like, I was so, like, I used to watch Grey's Anatomy and Scrubs, like, all of those TV shows. But I never wanted to be, and I knew I would be really good at it if I did pursue it. I had that feeling because I knew I had empathy. I had that interest. I love biology. But I didn't want to pursue it as a field because even back then I thought that it's you have to spend a lot of effort, a lot of time, and you have to make a lot of sacrifice in like the first 15 years of your career, and then you start reaping the benefits. Like, you have to work like crazy, and obviously I see that with my friends who are doctors now. So at that point I was like, no, I don't, this is not the, like, I'm not that motivated to become a doctor. I know I would be good at it. It is very interesting, but I personally didn't want to pursue it. And then again, if I wanted to go abroad, if I had done medicine, it made sense obviously for me to stay in Pakistan and do my medical school from there. But I really wanted to come abroad, and I really wanted to go to Oxford. I think that was like the biggest motivating factor for me. Obviously, getting into a medicine course at Oxford is, I think, close to impossible being an international student. So I knew that was not an option for me. So either it was computer science or biochemistry, which I was going to apply for. For computer science, I remember they suggested that the candidates should have further maths, but my school didn't offer further maths for that year, so I didn't take it up. So right. I knew.
Right. So it's add maths, would you?
A-levels ki add maths, So I knew that, you know, if that's a preferred subject, it would automatically put me at a disadvantage. So I decided to apply for biochemistry because, again, I wasn't too sure about my career field back then. Again, I loved, like, maths. I loved bio. I loved chemistry. And I also really liked, like, IT or computers, etc. So these were like my strengths. So then I decided to pursue biochemistry, and the course seemed very interesting as well. So that's how.
So it was your school life was very much sort of designed to get into Oxford, in a lot of it, like your academic journey.
Not your social life,
but your academic journey.
Yes, and and it
how
was
did it feel when you? Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to add, and it was more of a personal kind of journey, I would say, because again, no one from my school had ever gotten into Oxford, and even like my school counselors, they didn't really have much of an idea about the college system or about Oxford in general. So all the effort that I did was mostly at a personal level, because again, obviously not my school's fault, but they just didn't have those right insights or you know, that amount of information, like being a school in Pakistan, and like I said, having no student gone to Oxford before, they weren't really. So for example, like my when I got called for an interview, my school principal, so the counselor set up a mock interview with my school principal. Obviously, you know, they were doing all that they can in their capacity. I had read a lot about Oxford interviews in my own time, and I knew they're very much focused on the degree that you're applying for and your knowledge about your subject, rather than, you know, about your motivation for applying to Oxford or things like that. They're very academically driven. So I knew all of that, and that's what I was preparing for. But when I went into the interview with my principal, she obviously didn't know that. So she asked me like very basic questions that, okay, you know, why are you applying for this course? Why? Isn't she did best in her capacity. But I think they, you know, back in those times, I don't think they were like very well equipped to help someone get into like Oxbridge, I would say. At that point, obviously now things are so readily available.
Absolutely.
As well, with all the information that you can get on the internet, YouTube. Back in those times, I remember, like, it wasn't like there was a lot of information, like a lot of first-hand information available online.
Where were you when you found out you got in?
I was in my bedroom. I remember it obviously very, very vividly, because it was such a special experience. So they tell you the date that the decisions are going to be announced. Like, so they announce it on their website. So it was something around 20th, 22nd of January, if I remember correctly. So when I applied to Oxford, I didn't tell anyone I had applied, like in my, you know, family, in my, obviously like my immediate, my siblings and my parents knew, but I didn't like tell anyone else because again, I was like, I'm not going to get in. So, you know, what's the point of, because then people create such a big hype and they always are like, oh, you know, you are going to, and it, that too. And then I knew anyone was going to be like, oh, you know, tomara to ho jayega.
Oh, yeah,
and then
yeah,
the
yeah.
disappointment. So I was, yeah. I didn't, and I strictly told my parents that you're not telling anyone. And thankfully they listened to me. But in my school, obviously, because we were, there were a couple of students who got the interview invite. So we were having mock interviews and stuff. So only like people in my school knew, my friends knew, but no one else. But when I got the, when I knew, okay, the results are going to be announced on like the 20th, whatever of January, I didn't tell anyone, not even my friends, not even like my sister, because again, I was like, I'm not going to get in and I don't want it to be a big deal that, you know, throughout the day they're asking me, okay, you know, what happened? What happened? I was like, I'm just going to keep it like very low key so I don't feel that pressure. So I didn't tell anyone. And I remember my mom asking me like, and that day I didn't know what time the results are going to come out, so I was just constantly checking my email, and I was obviously very stressed. And but I was trying to act like all okay. And my mom's, I remember my mom asking me that, you know, is everything okay? Like, you seem a bit stressed. And I'm like, no, everything's perfectly fine. And then the whole day went by, and I just didn't get any email. And then I remember it was around like 7 p.m. back in Pakistan. I was in my room. And I had kind of given up, like, checking my email, because throughout the day I was checking it very frequently. And then I checked, like, I'd gotten an email from... So I got interviewed by Oriel College. I made an open application to Oxford. I got interviewed by Oriel College. So I had two emails. One was from them. So I opened that up. And they said, oh, you know, please find, attach the result of your application. And I opened the letter and it said that, oh, we're sorry to inform you, but your application to... that we had some, like, we had limited slots available, and you know, the application to Oriel wasn't kind of, you know, something along these lines, they wasn't successful. So I was so bummed. I was like, yeah, I expected it, whatever. But then the next line said that, oh, you, but you know, like, your application was good enough, and another college had a place, so you'll be hearing shortly from them. So the, and then I opened up the other email. It was from Worcester College, the college I went to, and my acceptance letter was attached to it. So I just got so excited. I ran out of my room. My mom was in the TV lounge. She was on the phone, and then I was like, oh my god, like, you need to hang up. And I told her, though, you know, I got in, and I started crying, and then she was so happy as well. She also, like, it was just so emotional that we were crying. And and then, but you know, I remember initially I was crying with happy tears, and then I got sad, and, you know, I'm like, I got upset, and she's like, why are you like upset? I'm like, okay, I got in, but it's so expensive.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll be able to go. And then she was like, no, your dad promised you, right, that if you get into Oxford, now he, you know, now it's his headache, not yours. He has to make it work somehow. And then, you know, I called my dad up and I told him, though, I got admitted, and he was so happy. And then when he came home, he was like, I told you, like, you know, if you get in, then I'm sending you. So, you know, don't worry about anything else. So yeah, it was very emotional evening.
Oh, that is such a lovely story. Okay, so, and then you were the first person in your school to get it.
Yeah. So in that year, we actually got two acceptances. So it was me for biochemistry and another person for history. So she also, yeah.
And then
she,
you
so
were the first two. Yeah, and this is LGS.
Yes, LGS, yeah. Like the Gulberg.
Which year
branch
was this?
It was 2015.
Oh, okay. So pretty recent.
Yeah.
Okay, now to Oxford.
Yeah.
Tell me about, you know, first impressions, like first year, first time you came here as a student.
So a bit of an interesting story. You know, I was fully geared up for coming to Oxford. I applied for my student visa. So both of my brothers, again, they'd come to the UK. So my dad obviously had gone through that process. So I was very chill. I was like, obviously, like, I'm going to get the visa. I did, my student visa got rejected, and that was such a big shocker for me. Like, and so I was due to, and like literally I had packed everything up, like my suitcase was packed. And when my I went to, and I remember even like the day before when I got the email that, oh, your application has been processed, you go collect it from Jerry's. So I remember I was gonna book my ticket then, I was in like a few days time, all my luggage was packed, I was literally just waiting for my visa. But my dad was like, no, like just get your visa and then I'll book your ticket. And then I went, and when I opened up the envelope, it said your visa had been rejected, and I was just like in shock, like in absolute shock. Yeah. Even when I remember, my sister went with me. So when I went back into the car and I'm just crying, and she's like, why are you crying? And I'm like, my visa got rejected. And she's like, nah, that's such a bad prank. Like, you know, such a bad joke. Like, I'm like, I'm not joking. It actually got rejected. And then she saw that letter and we were just shocked as well. It was such a kind of like a silly mistake. Basically, for the student visa, they asked that the funds for your first year of university tuition and your accommodation, etc., like they need to be kept into your bank account for, I think, the past for 28 days consistently. And so my dad had already, and that condition had always been there, so he did the same for like my brothers, because obviously it's a lot of money, you know. Yeah. You need to make sure that, okay, like you're not going below that amount. So he did that, but this time, again, because he just didn't think too much about it, he kept it in his business account. Whereas, so they rejected my visa based on the fact that the money was kept in my dad's business account rather than his personal account.
Oh.
So even, but you know, he was like, I'm the sole proprietor of this like account. Like it was under his company's name, but he was the sole owner of it. But they, but yeah, they rejected my visa based off that. And so again, I was just, like, you know, just absolutely like depressed for I think a month, because I was like, what, because the term was going to start in like 10, like freshers week was going to start in like 5 days or something. So then I was like, it's impossible for me to get to Oxford now. And then again, I think my so then I thought obviously I was gonna apply again, but I couldn't have a, because I needed to wait for 28 days for my dad to move that money to his personal account, because you know, you don't have this amount, these amount of funds sitting in your personal account. So he moved his funds immediately that day, but then I had to wait 28 days to apply again. And then the visa process takes like 6 weeks, so by that time it would have been what, November or something, or October. But obviously you have a last enrollment date from the university for when you can join the course. So my last enrollment date was in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks time at that point. So again, like I let the university know that my visa is rejected and I need more time. Again, I think they extended by 10 days or something. They'll speak to my tutor. But then my brother, who was doing his undergrad here, he went all the, like he came all the way to Oxford, he went to the college admin, he spoke to them, he let them know of the whole situation. And then they were kind, and they really tried their best, but they gave me the last enrollment date of like 3rd November 4th November, something like that. But again, that was literally like 5 days after the 28 days would have passed.
Yeah.
So again, I was like, there's no way I can get, even if I get like the fast track application, that also takes like 10 days or something for the student visa. So it's like there's no way that I can get to Oxford in time. And they were like, if you can't get to Oxford by like 3rd or 4th November, like we can't defer your application, you'll have to apply again next year, and you can't basically come. So I was just like absolutely like, just I remember it was just such a depressive time, I just couldn't believe that it's happening. But then again, my my parents, my family was very supportive, and I didn't really apply. So I applied to LUMS as well, but they asked, and I got in, they asked you to pay a deposit. I didn't pay that because I had received an offer from Oxford at that point, so I knew I was going to go in here. So at that time I was okay, I don't even have the LUMS admission, so I thought like I'm just gonna stay at home like for the year. But then so what my mom, and then again we tried like our best, but the only way we, like, you know, there was no solution for it. I had to wait 28 days and apply again. But then my mom knew. So at that time, Ihsan Iqbal was the Minister of Planning and Development. And my mom knew his wife. There's this school that their family runs. And my mom was also a part of it for, I think, again, like, either orphan children or underprivileged children in Lahore. So my mom didn't know his wife very well. Like, they were, like, best friends or anything. But my mom was like, okay, I'm going to, like, speak to her if they can do anything.
Yeah.
And they were just so kind. Like, my mom called her up and told her about the situation. And, you know, she was like, oh, she's so depressed. And, you know, I don't know. And obviously, I think, like, now thinking back, I think your parents want to do absolutely anything
and everything
that they can for their children. So, and I remember I was like, you know, even my mom doesn't like asking people for favors. And I was like, I also don't want to ask someone for favors. Like, it's fine. Like, you know, I'm not going, but, you know, we don't really know them that well. So it's just a bit weird that we call them up and ask them if they can do anything. But my mom, like, was like, no, I'm going to, like, still ask her. And they were so kind. They were like, so they asked us to come to Islamabad because obviously the embassy is there. And he was like that, so we went to Islamabad. And then when I met him, he was like, you're not leaving my house until I get your visa. Yeah, he was that nice about it. And then, and literally, he was like, he didn't even let us stay at the hotel or anything. It was like, you were staying here, because I was really, really depressed at that point.
Yeah.
And because obviously he was very busy, he used to come, like, home for dinner, like, later at night. So that, and so we would have, and then we stayed at his house, me, my sister, and my mom. And we used to have dinner together when he used to come. And every night he used to update me that, you know, I've spoken to the High Commissioner, this is what they're saying, this is what they're saying. So I had applied again for my visa, but based on, I think I paid my fees in advance, but again, like, you need to show the amount of your, like, living costs as well in your account. So again, there was just this technicality, the condition wasn't being met. So he stayed there for a few, and he thought that, again, like, you know, they might be able to do something. But then again, the High Commissioner was like, so for 3-4 days, they really tried their best. And he used to update me every night at dinner and really, like, motivate me that, you know, you are going to go. Like, I am going to make sure that you go. Don't worry about it. And his wife was super nice as well. Like, you know, throughout the day, like, she would just be, like, looking after us. And again, also, I could go to Oxford. So that was super, super kind of them. Again, I think they played, like, because of them, I was able to get here at the end.
I feel so much relief. Yeah. I literally was like, what happened?
Yeah, literally, it's the same thing. I think
for whole gear visa.
But, like, it
how long did it take?
So it did. So again, I think I applied the second time. They were like, there's no way that, because it's kind of like a checklist thingy, they can't do anything. So they were like, you have to wait 28 days, show us that amount. So then what they decided was that, so I went, they said, I withdrew that application that I made the second time. The plan was to apply again once the 28 days have passed. So I got the bank statements that they are traveled to Islamabad. I applied again with the document. And again, like, Ihsan Iqbal, he made, again, like, an angel in my life, he got my application processed in one day.
So, okay, so that was the plan.
Yes.
So you meet the conditions and the processing will be. Yeah.
So exactly. Okay. So yeah. So they really expedited my, like, application process. So then I got the visa in
This was such a roller coaster. Yeah. I was just like, okay, so did she come here?
Yeah.
Like, what happened?
At that time, I had no, again, I remember I was just super depressed. I thought, like, you know, my life is finished.
I can imagine.
Like, I got into Oxford and imagine not being able to come.
That is insane. It's also the cruelty of the visa regime.
Yeah.
It absolutely is what brown students have to go through.
They're stressed.
But at that age, when you get into your dream school and this happens, I cannot even imagine.
You're working for it for the past 5 years and then it's just like, oh, because of one technical reason, you like, and such a, like, small, stupid reason, you can't come. So,
but you made it.
Yeah, but I made it. I missed I came here like 3-4 weeks after. So I missed the freshers week. I came here like mid. I came here after 5 weeks. So obviously fresher weeks is like week zero. I came here at the start of week five. So term is 8 weeks long in Oxford. So I missed everything. Like the freshers week, the time when everyone settling in. So got to Heathrow. My brothers picked me up. We stopped at like, I remember, an Asda on the way. I got like my essentials and then... Then we got to Oxford in the evening. So my college, so you know, in colleges you have this like support system. Like you have like a college dad and a college mom. So they and my college siblings. So all of them. So they knew, okay, like you know, this situation had been going on. So they, like a group of people, they were waiting for me at the porter's lodge. So I came in and they helped me. Take all my stuff to my room, then showed me around college. Everyone was like super welcoming, super nice. And then my brothers were like, okay, we're going back. And I was like, no, please stay the night with me. It's it was the first time I was staying away from home or like living on my own, to be honest. I remember that first night being very lonely and very scary, and I was literally begging them, please stay, but they were like, you know, they have to go back. And so I think like the first year was really challenging for me because like things in Oxford move so fast, and I think the first few weeks when you're starting a course are very, very important. Like they set the basis for you, all of your concepts for the later years, and I missed all of that. And then the thing is, when I joined, it's like you're in the middle of the term, you're attending like lectures, labs, etc. every single day, which is like obviously like way more advanced compared to like the first few weeks. And so I had to catch up on the syllabus that I missed, but also stay on top of what was happening currently. But then also make friends, right? Or like settle, know your way around. Like I think it was just too much happening at once. So I really struggled with my first year and found it like, and I found it really stressful, really difficult. And remember when I went back for my first summer holidays, I told my mom that I'm not going back. It's too like, you know, I don't enjoy it there. It's I think it the major reason was that I missed the first 5 weeks of term. And she was like, Minal, like, you know, we made so much effort to get you there, now you're telling me you don't want to go, you're going back, like you're just now finishing your degree and then you're coming back, like, you know, there's no way now you're not completing your degree. She didn't want me to go in the first place. I'm very close to my mom, and she was like, you should go for your master's, not for your undergrad. But obviously when I got into Oxford for my undergrad, no one could really like say no. So she was like, you know, now we made so much effort, so much sacrifice to get you there, you can't possibly be saying that I don't want to go back now. But then I think when I got back and my second year started, that's when I really started enjoying Oxford. I really liked it, and I felt more settled in. But I think like the whole of first year was really challenging for me.
Oh god, this is just these are amazing stories. But again, it's also really interesting how this whole like borders and the visa regime sort of work their way into your entire first year. Because I can just imagine the mental exhaustion of having gone through the visa thing and then coming after literally half the term has passed. God.
You know, being an 18-year-old at that point.
Literally.
17, 18.
18. Yeah, exactly. This is insane. Okay, so a bit about, you know, what kind of friends you made, community, and, you know, initially and then later on when you were more settled.
So I think initially when I came, again, like, everyone in my college was very warm, welcoming, super sweet, but I did feel that, you know, everyone had kind of made their groups. Like at that point, everyone was like super close, like, because, you know, they'd been spending the past 5 weeks together, and I was kind of like, you know, someone new, like, and again, being from Pakistan, having never stayed away from home, and obviously it was a big cultural difference for me as well, like, coming from Pakistan, because all of like, most of obviously my friends in college, for them, you know, fun was involved a huge part of drinking and going out to clubs, especially I think when you're like you're in your first year of first 2-3 years of uni, to be honest, you have so much energy. So I think obviously I felt I didn't enjoy any of that. So I kind of seeked more of, so in my first year, more of like, you know, my, I would say like comfort space. There was, so obviously the girl from my school, Safa, who came to Oxford as well. So I, you know, like I spent a lot of time with her. And then there was another girl who was from LGS Defence, like the other branch of LGS. She also did my course, but she was a year ahead of me. So I reached out to her before coming to Oxford. She was super sweet. So I spent, for my first year, I think the Safa and Maham, like both of them were a kind of like, you know, like my support system. Spent like most of my time with them. And again, because they could really relate to, okay, you know, the phase that I'm in, kind of staying away from home for the first time,
yeah,
and then feeling the cultural difference as well. And, you know, both of them were from Lahore. Like, there was a lot of relatability. So I spent a lot of time with them. When I came back for my second year, then I was like, okay, you know, I need to make the most out of my, I didn't really, and I wasn't too social. I was more on the introverted side when I was in school. But in my, again, first year, I felt that it's very important for people to make you feel like welcomed, because I think I struggled with that in my first year. So when I got into my second year, I just really made an effort to make sure that anyone else who's like now in their first year, who's coming, especially from Pakistan, I used to make like a lot of effort with them to make sure that, you know, they feel very supported,
yeah,
they feel very welcome. Everyone says that, okay, you know, like you made us feel like very much at home. So I did that with like people in my first year. So I started going to like Parksoc and ISOC a lot in my second year.
Yeah.
I ended up making a lot of friends, both through the Pakistan Society and the Islamic Society. And I just really enjoyed my second year. I think it was the best, one of the best years of my uni life. We don't have exams at the end of second year. So that was also a good thing that you don't have that, like, you know, like,
pressure
exactly, that you're going to sit exams at the end of your second year. So yeah, like, and so I remember we had Ramzan in Trinity term in my second year that came in term time at Oxford. So I spent that mostly with the Islamic Society and with my friends, and it was one of the best Ramzans of my life.
This is when our common friend Aisha was here, or this
that
is
was the year after.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the year after. So that was again, like, I just so even in my first year, I remember like the day I came, the next day, because I was seeking some familiarity, I ended up going to the prayer room and I met like a few people there. Everyone was super sweet, super welcoming. Again, you know, this was when I was a fresher. So from day one, I think like I just had a lot of like, I seeked the ISOC a lot. I really felt that everyone was like super welcoming and the community was really nice. And
sorry, so ISOC is basically not only South Asians, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's more diverse.
Exactly.
And PARCSOC
is mostly,
so
yeah,
I wonder Asian. How that was different for you.
ISOC versus PARCSOC. Honestly, even in PARCSOC, they're mostly British Pakistanis rather than international. Like, there were a lot of British Pakistanis in PARCSOC as well. But again, there were a lot of like overlapping people as well. There were a lot of people who would be going to ISOC and PARCSOC as well. What I did feel was sometimes like international Pakistanis, they would have a judgment about the Islamic Society. Like, you know, they would think that, oh, like, they're probably very strict and, you know, they might be very judgmental. Like, they're like very, you know, like hardcore Muslims that go to the Islamic Society. But I had a very different experience. Like, when I went to the ISOC, like, I really felt being part of a community. Like, everyone was super welcoming, super sweet, super nice. I felt like there was no judgment whatsoever. Because, you know, in Pakistan, I remember, like, if you're going to the mosque, like, you have to make sure that you're dressed appropriately. Otherwise, you know, people tend to tell you off. Here, like, doesn't matter, people will literally, like, you know, even if you come in a skirt, you can, there would be abayas in the prayer room, you can just wear the abaya and pray, like, no one would have an issue, if you get what I mean. Like, people weren't really concerned about what others are doing, rather than it was more about, you know, how they can be, you know, supportive to other people. If, like, they, I just really felt a lot of warmth from the, from everyone in the Islamic society. So, because I remember I had friends in London universities, and maybe their Islamic society is a bit more hard, if you get what I mean. So they would always be like, you know, why do you go to the ISOC so much? Like, oh, you know, like, what are you doing? And I'd be like, no, like, but genuinely every single person was super sweet. Like, I had a great, great time. And obviously they were, not just Pakistanis in ISOC as well. They would be like, obviously like Asians, like Bangladeshis and stuff, but obviously like people from Arab communities, etc. So it was just, it was obviously way more diverse, but everyone was just, I felt like super sweet and super warm.
That sounds lovely. So Manahil, then, you know, ISOC really became like the source of comfort and community for you. Were you outside of ISOC, you know, in your college, at the university level, able to connect with a diverse range of, you know, students?
Yeah. Again, honestly, I would say that I would be able to, like, have a good conversation. I would have good acquaintances from, with, you know, everyone in my college. But, you know, being an international student, I always felt that I couldn't really, you know, like we didn't have the same definition of fun or same definition of comfort. So I think I did spend a lot of time outside of college and with PakSoc and with ISOC. And the thing with Worcester was also there wasn't a very diverse college. I used to go to LMH a lot. A lot of my friends were at LMH, and it is a very diverse college. Yeah. Worcester isn't like that. So I think that was also another reason that, like, there were literally like two or maximum three brown faces in like my whole cohort at Worcester. So I think it, even though I didn't really, you know, everyone I felt was super nice and super sweet, but it still kind of makes you feel a certain way when you don't see a lot of diversity around you.
Absolutely. I mean, that is something very interesting. Another thing that you mentioned, I think I've also, there's something that other Muslim students have said, that, you know, there's so much social activity around drinking.
Yeah.
That is what, you know, kind of plays a role in limiting.
Absolutely.
Did you also feel
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think especially when you're, when students come for university here, a lot of their like fun revolves around either drinking or going out for clubbing. And I think both of the things, obviously, like I didn't drink and I didn't really enjoy clubbing. I think I personally felt like if you're drinking, then clubbing is fun, otherwise it's really not.
Yeah.
So I think that was the reason that I couldn't spend a lot of time with like my college friends compared to like my ISOC friends or my PakSoc friends.
So do you think that Oxford sort of supported and accommodated your cultural and religious practices both at the college level and at the university level?
Again, I think so, like at Worcester, I think it could have been more supported. But it wasn't like that I wasn't practicing my religion. So, but again, I did see a difference between Worcester and then LMH. So we wouldn't have halal food served every day. So I had to like, so I would mostly eat vegetarian, or over the years, sometimes they would source halal, as in meat from halal butcher. So I would have to ask the catering staff if the meat is halal that day. They would go check in the kitchen, whereas, you know, in LMH all meat is halal and it's like written down, like, which is, you know, way more accessible, I would say, or way more welcoming for the students. But you know, but at the same time, I thought the people still were very welcoming and warm. I remember when I don't know who this was, but a lot of people that I would speak to, and I'd tell them that, oh, you know, I only eat halal meat, like in college, they would be like, it's absolutely unacceptable that the college doesn't serve halal meat. Like, you know, you need to like write to the college, and again, like, you know, they need to have your dietary requirements in mind for like everyday food as well. Obviously, if you're going for formal, they do have dietary requirements. But I did feel from like the student community, I did feel a lot of, I would say, warmth. And again, no one really had an issue, or you know, I didn't feel, no one made me feel uncomfortable that I wouldn't be drinking. They would respect that, but you know, it's just unfortunate that most of their fun does revolve around drinking. But I have heard this again from other people that sometimes, like, you know, people make you feel uncomfortable if you're not drinking, but I did not feel that with my college.
So I mean, what if you were recommended?
Sorry, I'm just going to add another thing. And then even at Worcester, I don't remember there being a prayer room. But LMH had a prayer room, so, because LMH is a way more diverse college, and I remember as soon as I entered LMH, I would feel more welcome as opposed to when I would be at Worcester. Like, LMH was way more welcoming than my college, and it's these little things that make all the difference, right? If there's halal food being served, if there's a prayer room, like, again, you know, being a Muslim, these are like your basic necessities, right? But not all colleges provide that.
Actually, that is a nice segue into what my other question was going to be. Next question was going to be is like, what would you suggest
okay.
at the university and college level that they do to make the environment sort of more inclusive?
Yeah.
You know, socially, culturally, in religious ways for Muslim students?
I think, like, again, like, for sure, like, the basic thing, like, there should be halal food being served, like there is there's all, you know, in Worcester there are always two vegetarian options and two meat options. There should always be a halal option as well, and it should be like very clear and written down. And same for the prayer room, there should be a space allocated for prayer for Muslims in the college as well. And then I think obviously, like, there should be more awareness as well, whether it's again like hosting like events, like social events, again to raise more awareness about like all religions, not just
Islam.
Yeah.
So so you've told me about, you know, the particular challenge as a Muslim that you faced, halal food, religion, etc. Anything else that sort of related specifically to accessing religious or cultural support that you had challenges here at the university or in the city in general?
I think so. Again, like, if you have, because there was a welfare rep and, you know,
diet.
I'm gonna take a toilet break.
Yeah,
in a bit. Yeah.
We can just I know how long you have been.
Yeah.
So maybe how much more time do you think you can give me?
20-30 minutes.
Perfect.
So I was saying that having a, because there was a strong like welfare system at the college, and you had a welfare rep and a counselor, etc., but none of those things, like, and they were obviously for students to feel supported, but I don't think they had an element of your religion or your faith or, you know, something customized towards that. So even if like you're speaking to college counselor, like college counselors, there should be, you know, an element of an awareness of your faith or your religion around that.
Do you want to go to the restroom?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll just pause this. The recording has been resumed. Wait, let me do both. Okay,
yeah.
So you were saying what other suggestions you have for improving inclusivity.
Yes. So one of them is introducing Muslim showers in all toilets across the college and the university as well. you know, like somehow accommodating like Muslim students, because it is a big inconvenience for us. And the second was that I remember in one of my university years, most of my tutes would be kept on a Friday afternoon. So I would I would go to the Friday prayers quite like every week, because for me it was also a chance to interact with everyone. It's such a community thing, especially I think when you're a student, it's such a good excuse to meet everyone, right? Because again, everyone's from like in the Islamic society, everyone's from like different colleges, different degrees, etc. But then everyone does come for Friday prayers.
Yeah.
So again, I would really look forward to that. I'd get the chance to like meet everyone all at once after after the Jummah prayers. But remember, one year most of my tutes would conflict with the Friday prayers, so I would miss that. And I think I just didn't feel comfortable speaking to my tutor that, okay, you know, because I don't think there's a lot of awareness around Friday prayers, around like halal meat and alcohol still, like, you know, there's more awareness around that. So maybe again, if tutors are given some training around, again, like all religions, what the you know, like what a day-to-day life would look like for a Muslim student, so they could be more, when they're scheduling tutes and stuff, they can be more aware.
That's a really good point. What about in terms of, you know, positive support experiences for Muslims besides the social aspect of like the societies? Did the university like support you in any way specifically for being, you know, as a, you know, if for your faith in some way?
Obviously, there's the prayer room, I think, which is a big positive, I would say. And especially because I was doing a science degree, the prayer room is right next to the science library and very close to the Baikim building as well.
Right.
So that was a positive. In terms of the college, I can't really think of much positives, if I'm being very honest. Like I said, you know, like halal food, it was up to me to ask the catering team that, okay, like, you know, is halal, is the meat halal or whatever. But I can't really think of any positives from at the college level. And at the university level, the only thing I can think of is the prayer room.
So, you know, you talked about ISOC and how that played such an important role in your social life here and making you, you know, giving you community and support. Have you sort of been to any cultural act, like any organization or event that promotes intercultural or like interfaith dialogue?
So we used to again not too many, but I remember being to like going to a couple of events which kind of promoted like it was kind of like an interfaith event, but again, I can't remember too much. I remember we used to do this grand iftar. It's done every year. And again, that's also an opportunity for all communities to come together and, you know, like have an evening meal together. And same way that I remember when I was when I was fasting, if Ramadan came in term time at Oxford, I would go to the prayer room to open the fast, because it just gave such a community feel. It's very depressing to open the fast on your own. There would be so people would be bringing their friends you know, to have a meal together with them. So literally every day you would see like people join you for iftar who weren't Muslims. So, you know, like that space was a very like open and warm and welcoming space, and they all really, every time anyone would come, they would really enjoy it, to be honest. So.
And were these people who were joining in mostly like international students or like South Asians or
no,
like,
they weren't South Asians. It was
like mostly white.
Yeah,
okay. So, you know, kind of like putting this all together, how do you think your identity as a Muslim sort of played a role in shaping, you know, your personal and academic journey at Oxford?
I think it played a huge role for me, to be honest.
How so?
Again, in my talking about like my personal life, I think like because I was like an active part of the Islamic society, like a lot of my social life also revolved, you know, like I wasn't just going to the Islamic society for their events and stuff, but like most of my friends were from ISOC as well, like a lot of them. So I think again that obviously like being a Muslim, that played a big role in my personal life. In my academic life, I can't really think of how it could like have an effect, like, and this is obviously like my faith really helped me survive Oxford, if I'm being very honest. Every time I would feel like there were times when I would think that I'm having a pan, like I'm gonna have a breakdown, like because again like studies were so it was very, the whole 4 years were very stressful at you know, at some point or the other. And I would, whenever I would feel like okay, not like I'm going to have a breakdown, I would go to the, at times I would go to the prayer room and just like sit there and maybe like revise there, because I would get that sense of calm and that sense of peace from the prayer room. So I think for my mental health, it was extremely important. I did tap into my faith a lot for again to survive Oxford, because it is stressful at the end of the day.
Yeah, that, I mean, that makes so much sense. And, you know, just as we go towards the end, I'm just going to leave it up to you what you want to talk about. But just want to revisit, you know, the thing you said about Eid.
Yeah.
So just more generally, you know, now that you've moved here and your family's back home and, you know, as an adult, like, how do you still, how is the sort of practicing of these rituals and, you know, the experiences of these festivals changed for you?
Yeah, no, I think they changed massively, because Eid just, you know, like recently passed. So I was reflecting over the difference, because I was like, it's when we were younger, there was so much excitement on Eid, but now being an adult, it's like, okay, you know, either you have, so I have a lot of family in London, so normally like we do get together at someone's place. So, but you know, even like going there, you obviously like as an adult, you do realize it's a lot of effort. You know, you have to, because we live in Oxford now, you have to travel to London, and then thankfully they try to keep it. We don't celebrate Eid on the weekdays, like do in the sense like do a family gathering, because, and I do work on Eid as well, like because as an international you know, citizen here, we only get about 25 days of holiday throughout the year, so I try to save them up for when I want to go back. So I've never taken a day off on Eid here. So if you're working on Eid, it doesn't really, it feels like any other day, first of all. And then, you know, by the weekend, you've kind of lost that excitement anyways. But I remember like one, if we're not traveling to we normally do try to do something with family. This year we did it with my husband's family. They live in Bath, like his brother. So we went there, just had an evening meal. I was working from home, and then in the evening we had a meal and then just came back. So, you know, you can't compare that to when you were a child and all you were thinking about is Eid, and, you know, you're literally just counting days and just, your life revolves around preparing for Eid. But as an adult, there's so many other things that you need to think about and so many other responsibilities. For example, like being an adult, like work, or if you are hosting people at your, because we did that like last year, that is also like, you know, such a big job, like you're just stressed about hosting.
Yeah, that you, but sorry, just for context, you and your husband are now living in Oxford.
Yes.
And what does he do here?
He teaches at the university, so he teaches maths and material science,
and he's also Pakistani.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, please go ahead. I just wanted to get the context.
Yes, yes. So yeah, I was saying that when you're hosting, then again, you know, you're not really thinking about the you're not really feeling that excitement of Eid, rather than what you're thinking about is, okay, I need to prepare this, I need to prepare that, I need to get everything ready. So it is very different, like life, Eid as an adult versus Eid as a child. But I think obviously it would also, I do understand, it would change when we do have children, because I think it's very important, because I think Eid is all about children. So, you know, then it's, it would probably be a different kind of an Eid compared to like right now when we're like two adults.
And then you also want to pass on those traditions.
Absolutely. So then it's up to you to create again that environment, especially like living here when that environment is not there. Like you want your kids to also experience that excitement of Eid, like making sure, you know, you're doing something on the 3 days and making sure that they're also excited about Eid and they understand like you know, why we're celebrating Eid and making it like really fun for them, so they also remember. Because, you know, when we think about our childhood memories, like Eid is such a big part of it, so I'm sure you also want to you know, give that to your children as well.
So anything else, Manahil, you know, you want to talk about?
I'm sure if you ask me questions I can answer, but at the top of my mind, I think just in summary, I just think like I really enjoyed like my 4 years at Oxford, and comparing it to what I had heard from my friends in London, I think like I was definitely like way more blessed, and it was a better environment for a Muslim compared to if I had went to like any of the London universities, to be honest, because I felt like in Oxford there's community plays a big role, like, and it's easier to create that community because Oxford is so small. Compared to like the London universities, and I generally felt that the community was also very warm and welcoming compared to any other universities that I had heard of.
I mean, obviously this is stuff that I know, but just for the interview, so you did 3 years for your BA here, then you did a master's here.
Yeah.
And so, and what was your master's in?
So all the science degrees at Oxford are 4 years integrated master's course. It's so you graduate with a master's degree. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you do 4 years here rather than 3 years.
And then after that you were...
Moved to London. I worked at Barclays in London.
Were you still working?
Yes.
And how has that been for you?
It's... I think the first 2 years were really exciting. It's a very different environment compared to university life. Mm-hmm. In terms of the opportunities that you get to grow as a person and you know, the skills that you gain. Like, I think university life is still very much about obviously like working on your intellectual capacity, but then in a working environment it's you have to develop way more skills. So I think I really got the opportunity to learn a lot over the past, like in the first 2 years. But then I think over time it did get a bit kind of stagnant and it wasn't as exciting. So now I do plan on leaving my job at the end of this year and working on my own project that I was telling you about. We're doing, we're planning summer schools at Oxford for high school students. So my plan is to go into education full time and leave my job.
Okay, that sounds really exciting. So just finally, you know, you're now living in Oxford, not a student, as a professional,
yeah.
And now you're married.
Yeah.
So it's a more, you know, it's a different kind of life. So how is it different, you know, more generally, I get it, but how is it different in being a resident at Oxford? Like, how are you experiencing Oxford differently in terms of community and like social life?
Yeah, I think it's very different because I have a lot of friends like from university. They're like, oh my God, you know, you moved back to Oxford. How is it? And I tell them that it is, you know, it's very different compared to if you're a student here versus if you're a resident here. Obviously, for example, you don't have access to college facilities, because as an alumni you can access college grounds and stuff, but you know, as a student you're literally like in college environment all the time. But Luckily enough, my husband is he's a fellow of LMH, so we do go to LMH quite a lot. So we still get that access to the university. And then I think we are in a blessed position, because I think it would be extremely way more different if you were just living here. But because my husband's part of the university, and then we're also working on this program, it's called the Oxford Pakistan program. I don't know if you've come across it. So very, very much involved in that. So we, because of that, we do have access to the student community. We interact with the student community quite a lot. So a lot of my friends in Oxford are now like, they're OPP scholars, or they're part of the OPP community, because we host events for the OPP community. I get the chance to interact with them. I get the chance to meet new people. I get the chance to make new friends here. But if we weren't, you know, doing the OPP, or my husband wasn't part of the university faculty, I think it would be like, you know, kind of like two different environments, or two different worlds that you live in. Obviously, one is that, you know, you're part of the university, which is like such a special experience. But as a resident, I don't think I would enjoy Oxford that much if we weren't still somehow associated with the university. But then life is very different.
That makes so much sense. Thank you so much, Manahil. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed, honestly. Like, I'm just going to, my experiences.
Thank you.